You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday morning, May the 11th, and it's time for the Friday Week in Review. Welcoming in two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the biggest political stories of the week. We'll talk about the latest debate between President Bush and Congress over war funding. We'll talk about the latest from the state capitol as well. And whatever you want to talk about, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. Please send your email soon or make your phone call soon. We'll be moving from topic to topic to topic because lots happened this week. And if you want to talk about something we're discussing, call in right away. If you want to bring up something else, just stand by. We will welcome in Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison, a contributing op-ed writer to the New York Times and noted blogger at althaus.blogspot.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also joining us, Georgia Durst-Lotti, professor of political science at Beloit College, a visiting professor of political science at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and author of Creating Gender, the Sexual Politics of Welfare Policy. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Well, the House of Representatives sent or did pass a war funding bill that some say is the war funding on the installment plan. It passed on a vote of 221-205, and President Bush said this about it.
And everything.
Oops, that's not what President Bush said about it. That was. That was somebody else. That was Gonzalez. We'll talk about him in a minute. But here's what President Bush had to say about the funding bill.
So I'll veto the bill if it's this haphazard piecemeal funding.
What do you think, Ann Althaus? Should he veto that bill?
Absolutely. I just think you can't fight the war like that. And it's a political move. I think eventually they'll have to get serious and come to a compromise. Right now it's some political interplay that I think's a little dangerous. I mean, obviously, if they defund the war, the failure of the war will be their fault.
Yeah, Georgia Durst-Lotti?
Their fault? Amazing. You know, I really think that the problem with Bush is the way he's gone about reacting to finally having oversight from the Congress is exacerbating the possibility of getting someplace useful. He's huffing and he's puffing, and he's not going to blow this Congress down. And it's really too bad. I was very pleased to see that he finally has admitted that benchmarks would be an idea. And I actually think that that this is going to go forward and he'll veto it, but something very much like this is going to come out in the end because that's what they need to do. I mean, we need to have some way of getting out of the dilemma we're in using the current policy. And so this is a move, and he's finally showing a little more flexibility than he has.
Yeah. Now, the House approved $43 billion to pay for the war through July in this bill. The additional $53 billion would have to wait until later this summer and would hinge on a progress report on how Iraq is doing. Why, Georgia Durst-Lotti, does Congress pass a bill like this when they know the president's going to veto it?
Well, for one thing, they have a mandate from the last election. You know, this is not just playing politics. This is what the people really voted in terms of a change in 2006. And so they're doing what the people wanted. And in this one, Bush is really out of sync. And you can look at his polls to see that is the case. This is a strategy that Congress, who has the power of the purse, can use to move an administration that has been absolutely fixed and not administering this war particularly well, so that this is one of the tools in their toolkit, and they frankly don't have that many when it comes to war. So this is one thing that they can do. And, you know, they're not really hamstringing what's happening. There's so much forward spending in the Defense Department that you know, the troops will have their money, and I cannot imagine that they won't actually come through with the money in the end to make the troops as safe as they have been thus far, which is kind of a sigh when you think about it. So, you know, I think that it'll come through in the end. This is the tool they have. This is what they have to use.
Let's remember how much of a mandate Congress had, the Republicans had, when they came into into a majority in 1994. They thought they had a big and it was much more articulate in that they had the contract with America. They had all of these provisions in it, and when they came in a landslide against President Clinton, they had a much stronger mandate than what we saw back in 2004, which is, I think, a pretty inarticulate, to the extent that it's called a mandate. I don't think that's proper. It was a narrow margin that was won, and it was on in individual races that were not all about vote for me and I'll bring down the war. So I think compare it to 1994 when the Republicans came in with a contract with America, and remember what happened when they got into a big head-to-head with the president over the budget. The president came out on top. So I think, if anybody has any memory at all, to think that this standoff is going to help the Democrats and going to set them up for 08, I think that's a huge mistake.
Well, I think that this head-to-head will help the Democrats. It is markedly different than the head-to-head that happened in 98, and time will tell, won't it?
I do think it's different. I think in 94, it was much more articulate what their program was, and when they went to go forward on their mandate and it came into a budget shutdown, people turned against the Republicans. What the Democrats came in with in this past year, in 06, had less substance to it. To characterize that as being about the war is just a big fake, in my opinion.
Let me bring in a few callers who want to talk about this. Steve in Oshkosh, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wonder if I could zero in on what Vladimir Putin said this week in an address commemorating the end of the Nazi regime. And he likened the U.S. to the Third Reich. And I wonder how that plays in with Tony Blair's demise and resignation and war funding right now, where half of the Americans, I think, see America as Third Reich in the world. And Vladimir Putin simply put it out there on the public stage.
Oh, yeah. Comparing things to Hitler usually works really well. That plays
Goering,
well.
I would say. How about Hermann Goering?
Yeah, compare people to the Nazis. That usually makes people say, yeah, that's about right. That's an effective argument. That's a famous bad argument. Usually when someone makes that argument, smart people say, all right, that's the end of intelligent conversation there. Yeah. I agree with that.
Georgia, just slide any comment?
Well, I agree with Ann that it's usually put out there as a way of stopping intelligent thought. But one thing that is important in the connection is that one of the things that the Third Reich did is make all sorts of really heinous things legal. And so when you look at some of the losses in civil liberties and some of the other things that this administration has tried to make legal, there are ways in which, as I think it was Senator Byrd compared, it actually, historically can be seen as somewhat accurate. I don't think Tony Blair stepping down has anything to do with this. I mean, it's 10 years. It's time for him to go.
Tony Blair is stepping down, though, in part because of the unpopularity of the Iraq War and Tony Blair's support of it. Isn't he, Georgia Gerslati?
Oh, I think that that's some part of it, but I think 10 years is enough, and I mean, he had basically said this earlier too, so I actually think Tony Blair, I mean, it's all the retrospectives on Tony Blair that have been out this week, I actually think Tony Blair was not just the Bush poodle that he's been charged as being here. I actually think he really believed that this was the right thing to do. You can recall that Britain has had a long history with domestic terrorism because of the Irish circumstance. And so they have a very different relationship to terrorism than we did. And I was just over there a couple months ago. And, the way in which Islam permeates that culture, because so many of their Commonwealth immigrants come from Islamic countries, it really has a very different feel to it. And I think Tony Blair believed that what he was doing was right.
I think Tony Blair was great, and I think people are going to miss him. Who is this new person? Gordon Brown. I think he's less articulate, less charismatic. Maybe people got a little tired of the articulateness and the charisma of Tony Blair, but I think we're going to miss him.
Well, speaking of new people, who's this Nicolas Sarkozy? Is he going to be a bush poodle, Georgia Derslotti?
A bush poodle. I don't know that he'll be a bush poodle, because at least he comes out with the good French, it's okay for friends to disagree, huh? I think he doesn't have to be a poodle because he actually believes many of the same ideological presuppositions that the Bush administration believes, at least about the economy. I cannot imagine that the French are going to be trying to become the world's policemen, as the U.S. have been. So I think there will be great differences on foreign policy, but on economic policies, that it doesn't have to be a poodle because he's right there already.
Mm-hmm. I think he's a very interesting character. I was listening to his victory speech. I thought he seems like quite a brilliant person who's bringing a new generation, new vitality to France. I mean, France wasn't helping us that much in any kind of poodle sense. So they were just, sort of ankle biting and speaking against us. I think having someone in the mix who's not just, agreeing with everything, but who has a perspective and a new perspective, who will be supportive and have a kind of a dialectical effect on the discourse in the future. And I think it will be a good way. I mean, I think France needs a lot of change, a lot of reform, and it's good to have a vibrant new person in the mix there, whatever he does.
Well, we'll have to see what happens domestically if calling unemployed young people scum is not...
He didn't call them scum. He was speaking French, and it was not really properly translated to scum. I think we shouldn't be too...
Well, let's just put it this way. They're rioting because of it.
Let me...
Well, what would you... I mean, those riots were a serious matter.
Still a serious matter. I mean, gets elected, and they're still rioting. That's my point. Yeah.
Right, but I think that he was someone who was willing to stand up to some forces that really need to be stood up to in France.
Well, we'll see how it comes out.
We are reviewing the news of the week, including the French elections, the resignation of Tony Blair, the latest on the war in Iraq, and President Bush's battles with Congress over that question. And we're not done with Iraq either. Let's talk a little bit when we get back from the break about the 11 Republicans who called on President Bush this week because of their concerns over the war in Iraq. We are talking with Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison, a contributing op-ed writer to the New York Times, and Georgia Derslotti, a professor of political science at Beloit College, a visiting professor of political science, and at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, if you'd like to join in our discussion of the news of the week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's our Friday Week in Review. Coming up this afternoon after 4 o'clock, Ben Marins and his guest will take your views on the news. Ben will be welcoming in Dick Haven, Associate Dean at the College of Arts and Communications at UW-Whitewater. That's coming up after 4. Our two guests, Ann Althaus and Georgia Derslotti, and you can join in 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Georgia Derslotti, how significant is it that 11 moderate Republicans came calling on President Bush this week, concerned about the war in Iraq and the president's credibility when it came to the war in Iraq, and what about Plan B, and how significant was that?
Well, it's not brand new, so in that regard, it's nothing earth-shaking, but it's really important for two reasons, and one of them kind of goes back to what Anne was saying before about the mandate from the 2006 election, and it suggests that members of Congress really believe that the war does matter, and it matters for their reelection, it matters for what their constituents think is going on, and the fact that they believe that the whole Republican Party is being damaged by the war is pretty significant. I think the other reason it's important, I alluded to before, is benchmarks. that we really do then see that benchmarks came into the vocabulary of the president after this conversation. And, you know, if we can find out what success would look like, what would progress be, since it's not defined, it would be wonderful to have something where we could actually move it along. And by the way, you know, this Robert Gates, many others who have been over there, top leaders of the U.S., have really urged the Iraqis to move and have cited what Congress is doing as the reason they have to move. So it could be a good cop, bad cop kind of foreign policy going on here, and, you know, with both sides actually serving a really important function. And I think the moderate Republicans are a symbol of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think there needs to be some kind of bipartisan resolution, but both parties want to make political headway, and they're looking toward the next election, but there's a limit to how much they can play for partisan interests with the war. You know, it's sort of like a game of chicken, you know, as they approach the precipice. But, you know, they have to get it together and do something, or the American people will be annoyed at both parties. The idea that one's going to win and one's going to lose, I think in the end they're both heading off the cliff.
Yeah, Cindy in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just think that it's very interesting that this Republican party's met with the president, and I'm wondering what you think is going to happen with the Republican Party. I mean, it seems to me that this war is damaging the Republican Party far more than they're willing to admit.
Yeah. Ann Althaus?
Well, no one's going to come out and just say, oh, this is really damaging us. They're trying to, obviously, they're trying to put a good face on it and talk about their being in the best position to carry things on in the future. You know, somebody's going to have to take over the war next year, and they'll have to do it competently. It's easy to sit back and, I mean, it's not easy. It's one thing to sit back and criticize. It's another thing to actually have the war in your hands and try to deal with it. I mean, we look back to the Vietnam era, and I can remember when everyone was frustrated and just hated Lyndon Johnson. And, you know, and then that turned it over to Nixon, and then it was Nixon's problem. So the idea that switching from one party to another is really going to solve it. I mean, the reality is there's a war and it needs to be dealt with.
Georgia Drisletti?
Well, I agree with Ann that the Republicans are going to spin this to put on the best face possible. What else can they do, really? But, you know, there are cycles in American politics, and the Republicans have had a run here, and this is when the war is one thing that really has not gone well for them. It is not a surprise, then, that the people are looking towards for a change. And I think that's what we have going on here. I think that that the Republicans will have a hard time holding things, but I never underestimate the Republican Party.
Vice President Dick Cheney went to the Middle East and to Iraq this week. And I don't know, though, did he, Professor Drisletti, convince the Iraqi parliament to not go on a two-month vacation this summer?
Well, that's what they said, though. But, you know, they are not our poodles, are they? We'll see what has to happen. We'll see what they actually do here. I think one of the more important things about Cheney going there was that lots of the leaders in the area didn't seem to believe that Rice was speaking for the president and for Cheney. And given the way in which the president has been so intransigent and inflexible on policy, and then Rice goes in and is clearly starting to open up policy to make a change, I guess I'm not surprised that they wondered if she had any authority to speak for the president, because it was such a change, and he has been so inflexible on all of this up till now.
So was Cheney's message, yes, Condoleezza Rice was speaking for the president?
Well, I think that that's part of it. It's kind of hard to know exactly what he was saying in that regard, but surely the symbols of what he was doing are consistent with that.
Well, I think it's very hard to look at what we were able to see and figure out what they were really doing or what was really being said. I don't have any sort of off the top of my head statement about that, what the two of them were doing together. You said good cop, bad cop before. I'm sure diplomacy is more subtle than that, but, you know, we see what we see, and what goes on behind the closed doors is another matter. But I certainly don't like the idea of them going on a two-month vacation. It's just such a slap in the face to Americans who are trying to get through something for them to just take off. But I guess, you know, there are different cultures.
Well,
and
know,
vacations, summer vacations mean different things in different parts of the world. Well, it doesn't play here.
Well, a couple of things. Of course, you know, it gets up to, like, what, 130 degrees or something. So
they do have air conditioning, don't they? They have all that oil.
Because they don't have electricity running.
But the government has its air conditioning.
Of a vacation, you know, when Congress goes on recess, or even when Bush goes to Texas, they're not exactly not working. And so the whole, this use of the word vacation, I mean, if they're back and they're trying to persuade the local tribal leaders to come along, if they're on the ground and they're doing things that help them come back and make a change, I mean, one of the things that I think is really misleading about the way political work actually occurs is that you have to somehow be in your office building away from your constituents to be doing any work. And, you know, that's just kind of crazy. So the term vacation, I think, we need to watch. And I noticed that Bush was using this on for Congress when they went home on recess over Easter. And, you know, what legislators do when they go home is not necessarily, you know, take the kids to Disney World. So I think that it perhaps is somewhat mischaracterized. On the other hand, and I think you're right, that they really need to be taking care of some business, like how are you going to give the Sunnis a piece of the pie? What are we doing with the oil revenue? What are they doing with their oil revenue? How are they going to divide this up? What can they do to stop the sectarian violence? I mean, I think that there is some basic work that needs to be done with all those folks in a room together, and I think that they're right to say, can you stay here and get some of this stuff done?
All right, another issue in the news this week. Federal authorities have arrested six men on charges they plotted to attack the Fort Dix Army base. Reportedly, the suspects wanted to kill as many soldiers as possible. All men are from the former Yugoslavia, five of them now living in New Jersey. Ann Althaus, you thought this was a pretty disturbing story?
Yeah, I did. I was upset to see that some people took it lightly and acted as if, you know, they were just a bunch of bumblers and clowns who weren't really going to be able to do anything. And how could you storm a military base? But the fact is, they had access to the place, and it actually isn't heavily armed, and they chose it because it wasn't. And it's full of reservists who are training and who don't have live ammunition in their hand and so on. So a lot of people really could be killed. And I think that those who take it lightly and don't take it seriously are, you know, living in a pre-9/11 world, because the story of what the 9/11 hijackers were planning to do would have sounded absurd before it happened.
Georgia Derslati?
Well, I think there are a couple elements of this. One of them, it came out in the paper this morning that their legal counsel is suggesting entrapment on the part of the FBI, who lured them into this plot, and that, you know, that they were incited into this plot. And there are really a couple things to say about that. One of them is, you know, it was pretty easy to lure them in, if this is the case. I mean, I don't actually buy this argument, but it was pretty easy to lure them in. And therein lies the big problem. So, you know, what's going on with Islam in general, or these particular young men in particular, that makes them want to do this? And I really think that we need to think about our stance in the world, our foreign policy, our domestic policy. I agree with Anne that it's very troubling this plot was actually in place, and I'm glad it was discovered, because this would have been awful.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified before the House Judiciary Committee in this past week talking about the controversy over the firings of 8 federal prosecutors, whether the White House played any role in the firings, and other questions. And here's Attorney General Gonzalez yesterday.
In everything that I've done here, the principles that I've tried to support are truthfulness and being forthcoming and accountability. And that's why we've provided thousands of pages of very internal deliberative documents, why we've made DOJ officials available for interviews and for testimonies, because I want to reassure the American public and this committee that nothing improper happened here.
The Attorney General said it's time to move on. Ann Althaus, you think so too?
I think it is time to move on. I think a lot of effort was put in as a political matter, as a partisan matter, to trying to attack the Bush administration with this story. They had some material. They worked the material that they had, and I just don't think they've made sufficient headway to keep pushing this story. I think the American people are past it. I mean, there's some kind of a mystery about the proper and improper grounds. There's certain amount of a policy that the administration is right to expect the U.S. attorneys to take seriously, like about immigration priorities and things like that, and other things that are improper, like firing someone because they won't bring charges against your political enemy. That's a very serious matter. There's an important line there. But I think the material has been pursued, and that, you know, we've reached the end of the point where any real headway can be made. The appearance before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday was really just a lot of repetitions, and I think it's clearly an impasse. I think it's definitely time to move on that one. I think, again, the American people have moved on, and if there's no more partisan gain to be made there, I think it will be abandoned.
Yeah. What do you think, Georgia Drisletti?
I think it was absolute stonewalling, and the notion of truthfulness and forthcoming is just like a great lie. It's amazing. And so this suggests that if you just stonewall long enough, and either you are lying straight out or you're incompetent, and you just bore the American public into not caring, if that becomes the way we govern, we're in really big trouble. And there, you know, how can anybody look at this and not see absolutely improper grounds for firing these prosecutors for partisan gain for the Republicans in key races? It's clear. It's absolutely clear.
Let me bring in David in Fenimore. Hi, David.
Hi. Good morning. I'd just like to say that I'm one citizen that is not willing to move past this issue. I think Gonzalez's testimony again yesterday, characterized as being truthful, is absurd, and I'm really surprised that there's a law professor from the University of Wisconsin that is consistently willing to take up the case and defend this corrupt and illegal administration, who are guilty of many crimes against citizens in this country and, you know, abroad, especially in terms of the legal profession being to administer and preserve justice for the people.
Well, that's pretty broad, but Ann Althaus?
Well, I don't know what I've said that really deserves all of that, but I think I'm trying to provide the other side, and I think that the president has certain powers. There are powers in the executive branch, and not everything the Democrats want means that Bush is violating the law.
Yeah. We will go next to Mike in Appleton. Hello, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I came late to the program. I don't know if you've touched on it, but to me, the real important issue is the situation with immigration. What do you guys think is coming down the tubes?
Comprehensive immigration reform, Georgia Drisletti?
I doubt it. It's big. It's complicated. It's not something that seems to provide the kind of neat and tidy partisan advantage that they want. I think they'll take it up after the 2008 presidential election.
Yeah, I think it'll be all talk, no action. I can't picture it. I can't picture them doing something seriously there. It's so tied up with various voting blocks, and I think there's more to be gained talking about it and saying things about it than actually putting something out there. I can't believe, unless somehow everybody decides they want to have some bipartisan achievement to show.
Well, that would be, yeah.
I find that hard to believe.
Well, that actually might work because, you know, I mean,
take it off the table.
Bush and the Senate were aligned before it was the House that was out of step. So, I mean, you know, they at least have some, we pretty much know what needs to happen. That's not a great mystery. It's getting past the conservatives who say you just have to follow the law.
And don't you think that the Democrats want to deny Bush any accomplishments? This would be his one chance to go out with a big accomplishment. Why would they give him that?
I would unfortunately agree that would come into play here. The question is, I think, going back to do they see enough advantage to themselves for solving the problem and perhaps the whole show of bipartisanship.
We're going to talk about some news from the campaign trail, the 2008 presidential campaign trail, when we return from the break, talking with Ann Althaus, a professor of law at UW-Madison, and Georgia Derslati, a professor of political science at Beloit College, our two guests this week for The Week in Review. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Again, going to focus on the race for president in 08 when we return. And we also have a number of state issues that we have to get to before we're done. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you. In the early days of the space race, 25 female pilots were asked to train in secret as astronauts. Only 13 were selected, the Mercury 13. After 9, Kathleen is joined by one of these trailblazing women. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with two trailblazing women during this hour. Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison, a contributing op-ed writer to the New York Times, blogger at althaus.blogspot.com. Georgia Derslati, professor of political science at Beloit College. She is also a visiting professor of political science and at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, author of Creating Gender, The Sexual Politics of Welfare Policy. A couple of things happened this week on the campaign trail that I wanted to get both of you to comment on. What do you think, Ann Althaus, first, of Al Sharpton saying that people who really believe in God are not going to vote for presidential candidate Mitt Romney, a Mormon?
Well, obviously he's trying to stir up prejudice against Mormons. He kind of phrased it in a way as if it wasn't him saying it. But, I mean, just imagine someone trying to stir up racial prejudice by saying, well, some people are, not me, it's not me, but they're saying. I mean, obviously, he's trying to bring the issue to the fore and plant it in people's minds. And I think it's just really, really, really wrong.
Mm-hmm. Georgia Derslati?
I don't think that this should be said, but at the same time, this is the history of Mormons in America, and there's been so much coverage of this very fact, the transformation of the Mormons from pariah to, you know, center of the U.S. mainstream, that, you know, it's right there. And by the way, people say about Barack Obama all the time that he can't win because he's black, so, you know, I don't think that it's hugely different in that regard.
What about Rudy Giuliani, Ann Althaus? I guess finally coming out in favor of abortion rights.
Did he make a statement yet? There was a New York Times article yesterday saying he was going to do it. Has he actually done it?
Headline I have here says that, but the story doesn't actually say he made a... It seems the revelations about his giving money to Planned Parenthood are forcing him in this direction. Right. But most people suspected he was pro-choice along.
And the New York Times had a story that he was actually going to just openly embrace it. Now, I don't think he's actually done that yet. But I think, you know, that may be the best direction for him to go because everyone kind of already knows he's pro-choice. And, you know, I think if he and his sounding being cornered into having to waffle about it, like at the debate last week, I think is kind of unattractive. It would be better for him to, you know, kind of reposition a little, be forthright about how he personally believes in a woman's right to choose. And that but in some way be accommodating and reach out to people who in his party are pro-life. I think there are ways to do that. And he's tried to do that. I think he can do it a little more articulately. articulately, but basically the idea is that it's not really the job of the president. It should be marginalized as an issue for the president, except to the extent that he's involved in appointing people to the Supreme Court. And with respect to the Supreme Court, he can talk about appointing quality candidates. And that's really what he's doing. He uses the buzzword strict constructionist. But, you know, I think people need to understand that that doesn't really help that much with respect to the abortion issue, because the abortion issue is, you know, it's precedent. It's already been decided. You'd have to overrule something. So, you know, you can be a strict constructionist and still not overrule everything. So it's a way of kind of encapsulating the argument and kind of leaving it into question, but being less conservative than some of the other candidates. And, you know, there are a lot of people who might want to vote for Republicans if they could get someone who wasn't socially conservative. I mean, I think there's a big group of people in the middle who want someone who's tough on national security, has good judgment, good executive experience, but doesn't buy into the whole, you know, social conservative package.
Yeah. Oh, sounds like Hillary.
That's right. I think Hillary and Giuliani would present a subtle, you know, a subtle comparison in the middle. I'd like to see that.
How about Barack Obama on the campaign trail this week telling a crowd that 10,000 people died in the Kansas tornado? And then saying, oops, I was tired. Yeah, I mean, he didn't really believe 10,000 were killed, the Ann Althaus.
Well, you know, it's a funny number to say. It makes you wonder how well-grounded he is in, you know, real concrete facts. He speaks very often in abstractions, and people have been inspired. But, you know, when he comes down off the abstractions, is there going to be the substance there? This might be a first peek into maybe he really doesn't know that much about what's going on in the world, and he's fine talking about hope and all of that stuff. And people get jazzed up about that. But at some point, he has to show that he really has a firm grasp on things. And to come out with a number that's that far off, it's like if someone said there are a quadrillion people in the world, you would say, you know, even if you're tired, you don't say things like that. I mean, what, 10,000, if 10,000 people had just died in Kansas, that would just, you know, we would all know about it. It's just such a weird thing to say. And, you know, if you're going to say, but I got tired, well, we're trying to pick a candidate who can go through a grueling campaign, not somebody who gets tired early on. But that said, Bush was famous for getting tired, and he somehow made it to the end.
Yeah, well, let's get John in Burlington might come to Barack Obama's defense. John, go ahead.
I think the whole thing you said is so ironic. I can't, you know, the whole, do you want hope or do you want someone who knows what they're talking about? And our current president, I feel like, has no clue what he's talking about. Has no, he can't relate to the common person. And the whole idea that, you know, they all assume that we're, it's insulting how you said, you just said it earlier about how, you know, the Gonzalez thing, we've lost our attention span on that, and it's expired, and
yeah,
you know,
John, we're not talking about that anymore. You were going to talk about Barack Obama, I thought.
I think you know, if nothing else, if you're talking about a person who's inspirational and is actually going to, you know, instill hope in people, I think that's, you know, a lot better than the other candidates who know what they need to say in order to get where they need to go, but don't really, you know, just kind of assume everybody's, you know, half paying attention, and, you know, when they vote, they'll vote for what we keep saying over and over again, and you know, that's the end of it. You know, I want someone who actually seems to care about the people, and you know, I don't see much of that.
Well, seeming to care about the people is just an illusion, too. I mean, if you're worried that people are being played, why isn't that being played, too? I want someone competent. You know, you can say, oh, well, Bush is, we're not comparing Obama to Bush. You can say, well, Bush has been bad, he's been incompetent, but so let's pick someone competent. Let's be serious. Let's focus on reality.
So I think, Anne, the way you set it up before, we should just compare Barack to Reagan. Didn't have a grasp on the facts and was enormously inspirational.
Yeah, well,
Reagan turned out to actually have some substance, although
well,
he did
you
have,
don't
he
think
had
Barack's going to have substance? Come on.
I'm waiting to see. I'm a little worried.
He has not been tested the way
he's
that...
He's very green.
He
right.
has not been tested the way that most of the other candidates out there have been in the public
experience.
Eye. And so, you know, I guess it comes as no great surprise that he stumbled a little bit here. But, you know, to suggest that he's not competent, and when I look at Ronald Reagan, you know what I mean?
But he's not running against
him. It is, you know, beyond my ken that he has less of a grasp on details than either the current...
You know,
he's not running again. I'd like to see him. Put him up against Richardson, who is a candidate that has a lot of experience, who has executive experience, who, you know, who's been a governor, who's done diplomatic great foreign affairs work. Look at him. Why aren't we looking at him seriously? Let's pick someone competent. Let's not talk about how Obama is maybe as competent as somebody who he isn't even running against. Let's pick someone competent this time.
Let me get in one more caller on this, and we have to move on to some other issues. We're almost out of time. David in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to draw the comparison between Barack Obama and his comment about 10,000 people dying in Kansas and what would have happened if Dan Quayle, who was also, you know, a beginner kind of guy, got nailed for an E on potato, which is even, you know, like a less of a slip
nailed
in my
the
mind.
Potato.
I mean, I can think maybe he couldn't spell. Okay, fine.
All right. Do you think, Georgia Durislati, that Barack Obama got a pass on this one?
I think Barack Obama is getting a pass on a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, let's. I don't think Tommy Thompson made any gaffes on the campaign trail this week, did he?
Well, he didn't make a good showing for himself
at the debate last week.
I just think it's impossible for him. He needed to make a good showing there, and I don't think he appealed to people.
And I understand he wasn't feeling well too, which was part of it.
That's a shame.
Yeah, that's what his campaign says. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was going to bring up the White House threat on the veto for the hate crimes bill that was passed by the House early this week. But to bring around the Obama.
No, we gotta stay on that because we have to do one issue at a time when we're almost out of time. The House passed the hate crimes bill. I don't know if it was a hate crimes enhancer or that you would get more of a penalty if.
The federalization of crime. I think that there's a good conservative argument that has to do with not federalizing more crime. You're talking about things that are already crimes at the state level. Why are you transferring prosecutions into the federal workload? What are the things that should be crimes? Where do you need the federal government to be investigating and prosecuting crimes? And where are things best left to the states? I mean, some of these laws that federalize crimes are just, you know, sort of making a show for the constituents that Congress cares. But you need to think realistically about who really should be prosecuting these crimes.
One of the things we know from the civil rights era is that the blessings of the federal system are that they allow for multiple entry points. So if you happen to be in a state that absolutely lets civil rights violations run amok, then it's good to have
possibility.
It's good to have multiple entry points.
It made sense with respect to black people. But I it's good to have the federal government where the states fail. But before you pass a law federalizing crime, show us that the states have failed. Show us that there's a reason.
Such as in Wyoming, or let's pick a few places where
we got to move on, and we will.
They don't prosecute murder in Wyoming.
We are going to be doing a program on this, I think, on Monday. So we'll get into more depth with some guests on the federal hate crimes legislation on Monday. Because Tom in Viroqua has been waiting all hour, and we're almost out of time, and we need to talk about some state issues. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, very briefly. Big news in state environmental issues, and actually this is a Tommy Thompson legacy issue, is that the Flambeau Mining Company has filed its formal evidence and testimony on the reclamation hearings that are coming up, public hearings this week up in Lacey for the reclamation of the Ladysmith mine, where they're trying to get approval by the DNR that this mine has been totally safely reclaimed and they get their reserve money back. And there's a public hearings coming up this Wednesday and Thursday up in Ladysmith on that. And then 2 weeks later, there's going to be formal contested hearings.
Yeah, and why are you concerned about this?
Well, because the mine has not been performing as they predicted it would. They have not done the reclamation activities that they said they would, and essentially it's a major environmental time bomb that's sitting there, threatening our groundwater and the Flambeau River, and the mining company is trying to get complete absolution for the bad job that they did in performing this.
I'm not sure our guests are really up on this particular issue.
I guess they're going to have hearings, so I hope they do them well.
I thank Tom for bringing this up. I wasn't aware of this.
Yes, and we will follow that one, too. Maybe we'll do something on it next week when those hearings are taking place. The state Supreme Court did not dismiss a conflict of interest complaint against Justice-elect Annette Ziegler. The complaint was filed by the State Ethics Board. So I guess is it the State Supreme Court that's going to hear these complaints later this month? I'm not sure
what the procedure is. I don't think it is.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the question was whether or not the Ethics Board could rule on basically a Supreme Court justice. And, you know, it's an interesting checks and balances kind of question, separation of powers kinds of question. And what I found interesting is that the court ruled that while the executive cannot, the legislature can, and the legislature basically has authorized them to do so, so that they are able to do so. And, you know, if you think about this, by Ziegler's argument, no one can check the court, and that's ridiculous in our system.
Yeah. Do you have anything on this investigation, Ann Althaus?
Not in particular. I mean, I think it's rough for a new justice who's just been elected to come in under a cloud like this. But I mean, since there is, you know, I don't see a reason not to follow through on it either, whatever the procedures are. I mean, there are checks and balances. The question is how much of them there should be.
Yeah.
But apparently, this one is going to go through.
Boy, there's so many state things, little things here and there that passed in the state legislature. I'm trying to figure out which one to end the show on. How about, because we've done things with pros and cons on this, the bill that would make it easier for telecommunications company to get involved in video franchising or competition to cable television did pass in the state assembly. This is the one that AT&T especially wants to see happen. We got news this week that Democratic Party Chair Joe Winicky is a lobbyist for AT&T, and some people raise their eyebrows over that. Georgia Durislati, any thoughts on this particular bill?
Two quick ones. First, in the scope of things like, you know, senior care and some other kinds of problems that we need to face, this seems small. On the other hand, anytime we're messing with the media, I think democracy is at stake. So how this plays out is really important.
Ann Althaus?
I haven't studied this enough to have an opinion, but more competition sounds like a good idea on the surface.
Well, speaking of senior care, Governor Doyle did unveil what he wants to be a replacement for senior care just yesterday or the day before. It's important, Georgia Durislati?
Hugely important. Mm-hmm. I think you all know that my mother-in-law is very much involved in all of this, mother-in-law who has Alzheimer's, and she's going to come out better because the foolish federal government is going to kick in, what is it, $180 million more? I mean, this is such a boondoggle for the drug companies. If you want to end on something on campaign finance reform, I'd say let's just draw the dots in a straight line between what the federal government is insisting upon and also the ruling not to allow to be able to negotiate drug prices. And let's just draw a straight line straight to campaign financing.
We are done for now. More in the state capitol report Monday after 7 o'clock. Georgia Durislati, thanks a lot for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Ann Althaus, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.